first in war, first in peace, and first in the fear of his countrymen. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be with you on this beautiful night. We're recording this on Sunday night, and even though we're supposed to get some rain a little later on, I'm telling you, I'm sitting here with the door open. I can hear the sounds of the night. It's beautiful, Barry.
Oh, yes. Well, we've had some gorgeous weather. It is, though, early spring and in Ohio, and so therefore any day now we could have 8 inches of snow or sweltering 90-degree days, which seems like we're going to be getting this week. So maybe both. We don't know yet.
That's right.
But anyhow, you know, Chuck, I know that today is officially tax day, and we're recording this on April the 15th on Sunday night. So, you know, we were thought about talking about taxes today, but honestly, ladies and gentlemen, everybody's going to be talking about taxes. And you know that taxes are too high, and that you know that you're paying for a lot of things that you don't get any service from. And a lot of your tax money is going for great things like, oh, I don't know, Secret Service members paying for prostitutes. But we're not going to talk about all that today because we found something we thought was much more interesting and important to talk about on this Monday, and that is that even 231 years later, this person's name is still bringing fear to his enemy. We just thought this was very interesting. What happened, ladies and gentlemen, was here recently, the National Army Museum of Britain decided that they were going to conduct a poll and to find out who the greatest military foe in history was for Great Britain. They were going to find out, they started out with a list of 20 names of some of the greatest foes that they'd ever faced, including such names as Erwin Rommel and other people, Tipu Sultan, the Tiger of Mysore, others who, if you read your history books and you look at English and European history, these names are going to come up very clearly as men who were very strong and very tough opponents that the British Empire and Great Britain have faced in their history as a nation. But, Chuck, when the dust settled and when all the votes were in, at the very top of this list, the top finalist of five incredibly important military leaders was one that I think most people would find kind of strange considering the vast, deep history of the British Empire. And that is the fact that our own first president of the United States, George Washington, with 45% of the vote, has been named the greatest foe Britain has ever faced.
Yeah, that's 45% out of five candidates. That's a phenomenal showing, I would say.
Well, he more than doubled the second placeholder there, who was Michael Collins, who transformed the Irish Republican Army into a machine that fought the British to a standstill in the Irish War of Independence. As a matter of fact, some people have seen the movie, I think, with Liam Neeson about Michael Collins that was recently out here a few years ago. But Mr. Collins, who came in second place, only garnered 21% of the vote. So George Washington more than doubled the vote total.
Collins is his closest competition.
Very close. Followed there a little bit farther back by someone whom our listeners would know of. Most people who study history have heard of this name, Napoleon Bonaparte. And you would think for all the historical movies and television, and there's been a miniseries on Napoleon, that in the minds of the British, Napoleon, since he was so close in proximity to the British Empire, as far as being from France and his attacks on Britain, would have been higher up the list, but he came in third. And Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox of World War II, came in fourth with a 10% ranking. And fifth place is the fifth most out of 20 that they picked was Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. The Battle of Gallipoli in 1915, he only received 6% of the vote. So basically, George Washington was nine times the foe Ataturk was. He was almost five times the foe Erwin Rommel was. He was three times the foe of Napoleon Bonaparte and twice as dangerous to the British Empire as Michael Collins. I think this is an interesting, when your enemies award you accolades, you've done something right.
Well, and one thing in your introduction, you said first in fear of his countrymen.
Yeah.
Well, His countrymen did not fear him. His former countrymen feared him.
That's right. Because that was the whole kick about the separation from Great Britain. The colonists wanted to have the equal rights of Englishmen as they were. So England was their country until they had to separate and form a new country. And yes, George Washington was first in the hearts of his new countrymen, but he was also first in the quaking fear in the boots of his former countrymen.
And that's right. And a lot of people don't understand that the first year of the war had nothing to do with independence. It didn't become the War of Independence until 1776. Well, the war started in April 1775.
Mm-hmm, that's correct, with the British impressment of Boston.
Oh, that's right. And the attempt at, also a lot of people don't understand what Lexington and Concord were about, and that was the British deciding that they were going to practice a form of gun control.
Yes, they were going after the armory that was being held there. The colonists had most of their guns and ammunition stored in armories in those places.
That's right, and they were going to basically take the ball and the powder and cannon that the local militias had stored there. And what they basically found out, that unfortunately the word had passed, and that ball and powder was then used not too successfully at Lexington, but at Concord, extremely successfully, and then very successfully on the, I think, the 18-mile march back to Boston. It was used highly successfully, and the British did not fare well on that march back. The march back was a forced march. I think they lost over 200 on that march back, and that began the siege of Boston, which essentially, when the Connecticut militia captured Fort Ticonderoga, again, people don't understand that was an independent state militia that did that. There was no national defense force at that time.
No, there was not.
There were just simply independent militias. Well, the Connecticut militia captured Fort Ticonderoga and wheeled all the cannon over to the Boston Heights. And at that point, Boston became untenable, and Gage was forced to pull out. So hence the real beginnings of the War for Independence. And I don't like calling it a revolution, as we've discussed before, because the British were the revolutionaries, not the Americans.
Exactly. And I actually, just last week, I discussed this with my Institute on the Constitution class as to the reason why it troubles me every time you see a new word on this period and in this conflict. It's always referred to as the American Revolution. But if you looked at the historical definition of the word revolution, based on Noah Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the English Language, it was based in the root word revolt. And to the colonists, the definition of revolt was to rebel against God's ordered authority. And that was something that they absolutely had no taste for. And the reason why the Declaration of Independence was issued was to spell out the ways in which the king had broken covenant with the colonists, whom he had a covenantal arrangement with. And so that therefore they were not rebelling against an ordained authority. They were saying, we have been abandoned by that authority and are being treated as subjects to a tyrant, and thus, therefore, we must separate and must form our own government. And honestly, the British understand this. As a matter of fact, and Dr. Stephen Brumwell, who was one of the experts who the National Army Museum in Britain had brought in on this as one of the voters, he noted that he said, now, Washington scores highly as an enemy of Britain on three key grounds. Number one, the immense scale of damage he inflicts upon Britain's army and empire. The most jarring defeat that either endured. Second, his ability not only provide inspirational battlefield leadership, but to work with civilians who were crucial to sustain the war effort. And three, the kind of man he was. You see, character matters even to your enemies. And looking back, you know, this was one of the things, basically said, you know, this man took what they still refer to as the American rebels. See, the British like to say, well, you guys were rebelling. Although they still call it the War for Independence and not the Revolutionary War in Britain. So they understand what the war really was about, even though they like to try to maintain the fiction that the Americans were rebels against the British Empire.
Well, Barry, that whole thing about Washington's character being so important, that's absolutely correct. And the way he comported himself during the whole thing, there are things that a lot of Americans don't know about attempts to replace him by jealous rivals, the fact that he used his own money to feed his army, when supplies were not being forthcoming and the Army hadn't been paid sometimes in years.
Yes. And when they finally were paid, they were paid in continental script.
Very often, or as we saw with the problem in Shays' Rebellion, and if you don't understand this, I do a two-hour lecture on this, and those videos are available from campamerican.com. Soldiers were very often paid in what at the time were worthless bonds, state bonds, for which speculators would buy them at 10% or so or less of face value, and then later attempted to collect at full value when there was no more inflation of the continental dollar, when the currency had deflated. They attempted to collect at full face value, which actually caused major taxation issues, which reignited a revolt. But Washington, of course, was heavily involved in the entire history of the country, and it's because of this character that the British have taken note of.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, Washington had more than doubled the vote of his next closest competitor, who was Michael Collins. And I thought it was interesting as I looked through this article that we read. This is from the Telegraph newspaper from Britain, spelling this out, that when they talked about some of these other military leaders, they basically talked about them that, well, they had a lot of administrative skills and they were very political. And when referencing Napoleon Bonaparte, that he had an unerring gift for propaganda and self-promotion. And when talking about Rommel, that basically his sheer tenacity and his skill made him a great enemy. It's only Washington who is awarded a honor of his own enemy, saying it was because of his character. Wasn't
exactly
because of skills or tactics or political acumen. It was because of the kind of man he was. The fact that he could bring together, as they said, even though he was outmaneuvered by British generals with larger armies, he could hold together an army of secessionists. This is the British talking now. Secessionists from 13 different states and keep it in the field during this protracted struggle. And we know if anybody's ever studied the early mementos of some of the battles, especially around the New Jersey area, mainly what happened was many of these conscripts in the early Continental Army, as soon as their enlistment time came up, they just disappeared. There wasn't any re-enlisting. These guys were there one day, and the next day they were gone. So keeping an army on the field became quite a challenge for General Washington.
This was a major issue with some of the militias. Now, the Continentals, who were actually militias who stayed throughout the war, there were Continentals who served 8 years.
Okay, well, I take that back. I was mainly talking more about the militias.
But you're right. There were some there were Continentals too. Now, let's not get this. There were Continentals who walked away when their sign-up period ended, but some of them also came back, and some of them actually went then and served in local militias while the war was still going on. It just depended where the war was at the time, because if you recall, that war moved around. It started in Boston, ended up in New York and New Jersey, and then the Philadelphia area. And then that battlefield heated up. And then, of course, at the end of the war moved south. And that's where they lost the war, really, was in the south, where they brought in Cornwallis, who basically treated the Southerners as enemies. And the Southerners probably at the time were weighted slightly in favor of the British. And after about 3 months of dealing with Lord Cornwallis, he had managed to take everybody who was sitting on the fence and push them over to the colonist side, and even converted some of the loyalists over to the other side through his tactics.
Yes, that's true.
So if they had had someone of Washington's character in their own army, the result may not have been the same. Let's put it that way. But they didn't. And that's providential, Barry, and that's kind of the whole point.
And that is the whole point. Washington's character was formed because of his faith. It was formed because he was a man who trusted in the divine guidance and providence of God, and who, if you read through Washington's works and his writings, and especially if you read his farewell address, which our class at the IOTC right now is having to read, Washington's farewell address, you see a man whose faith was deeply important to him, and who formed his character, which also formed his decision making. And those are the kind of things that have, even after all this time, Chuck, have led the British to still believe he's the most important foe they've ever faced, because his leadership basically was, as Professor Brumwell stated, the most jarring defeat that either the British Army or the Empire ever endured.
And unfortunately, we are now out of time. So join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.